The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, with what's going on in the gold market right now, there's a lot of questions as to how far can it correct, how far can it go up. There are a few experts who've been in this industry for 4 decades. Probably one of the most well-known as far as his technical analysis is Ian McIlvaney, today's guest.
Our conversation with Ian today, Kevin, is of incalculable value to our listeners and clients. And you know, he sees things with a clarity that I think many analysts lack. His observations, they unpack the themes depicted in charts and graphs, all of which tell a story and beg for meaningful exposition, which is exactly what he does month in, month out with his newsletter. And I hope today we have the same experience.
Well, let's go to that conversation right now.
Perspective is something that many in the investing public lack, often through no fault of their own. And our guest today has described most investors as confused as a herd of goats on AstroTurf. And perspective and insight are what we seek to bring with the many guests on our program through the ideas we entertain and discuss each week, whether it's Otmar Issing or Alan Abelson, Mark Faber, Stephen Roach. Each guest brings a certain nuance or insight that comes from both an in-depth study as well as a broad professional experience. And so we've invited Ian McIlvaney today to join us and discuss the markets. Of course, on the program, we look selectively at bonds, the equity market, housing, precious metals, and we have the opportunity to discuss all of these in depth with a veteran of the markets. Ian also shares an interest in gold and silver that goes back decades. He launched his newsletter, Deliberations, in 1972, the same year, in fact, that we entered the precious metals market as a company, providing wholesale supplies to the major wirehouse firms and individual investors. So the interesting thing about Ian's newsletter, it's in a class of its own, and it sits amongst a small peer group, whether it be Richard Russell, Jim Grant, Jim Dines, Harry Schultz. There's a very few people who've been thoughtfully writing and investing in these markets for decades, one that I consider to be an invaluable resource. You can look at the link and go to his website if you're interested in a sample subscription or a long-term subscription to the newsletter, which I would encourage you to do. Oftentimes it helps to begin with general observations and get specific. We want to look both at secular trends today, things that are currently in motion, and then perhaps sharpen our focus onto more cyclical trends. Starting with credit, Ian, there's some things that have been driving the markets, whether it's the bull market in equities of the last few decades, or frankly the bull market in bonds for the last few decades, and some of that comes back to credit. You know, the period from 1982 to 2006 witnessed a collapse in the savings rate, an explosion in debt relative to GDP, and it seems that some of those trends may be in transition. What do you think?
Absolutely. And basically, we've got a generation of American consumers that basically ate their homes one brick at a time. And subsequently, you've seen the credit markets explode. And in essence, they've lost value on their homes, but the debt is still there. And they're not going to be coming back spending anytime soon. To me, America really has been living beyond its means essentially since about the 1968 to 1971 period. It started with the, you know, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society and the idea that you could have a great society and fight a war and not pay for it. And in essence, the debt-to-GDP ratio just exploded until the credit markets finally blew up in 2007. And in essence, I think we're heading into what I would call the second half of that crisis, because the government bailed out the banking system after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, and the others. And now we're at the stage where the guys that did the bailout are coming under the microscope. And to me, it's gone beyond sort of a domestic bailout situation to questioning the credibility of the global currency system. And in many respects, the transition that's occurred over the past decade has seen China, Brazil, Russia, India, Korea, Japan end up with all of the, shall we say, the international foreign exchange reserves, and yet Europe and America are basically destroying the values of their currencies by trying to borrow their way out of debt. To me, we're at an extraordinary period of time. in which I've been seeing for some months now that I think we're headed into what I would call the second half of the 2007 crisis.
Now, the thesis that we're in recovery, and in fact, the recession ended some time ago, you know, would imply that there will be very quickly a recovery in housing, and that the financial sector will be coming back to a vision of prosperity, perhaps that's reminiscent of the 2006 and previous period. As you mentioned, 2007 is when the credit markets blew up, but it seems like the administration currently in Washington is putting together policies which would bring us back to that pre-2006 vision of prosperity. Do you see that coming together in housing and the financial sector the way that they would imply?
No, not at all, because among other things, just prior to the blow-up in 2007, the U.S. economy literally was creating about $8 of new credit market debt to add $1 to GDP. And, you know, again, I keep coming back to the phrase, how do you borrow your way out of debt? The consumer is not going to be able to come back because the mortgage-backed securities and the asset-backed securities markets at that time were throwing something on the order of $110 to $130 billion a month into the system. And basically, those markets now are generating maybe $10 billion a month, and the Fed is largely the buyer. And the problem that we've got is, in essence, the Fed is trying to replace that flow of money under the QE2 program, where they're throwing about $110 billion a month into the system, trying to create another stock market bubble to somehow get the consumer feeling better and go back onto a borrowing rampage. But the credit market facilities are not there to enable that credit to flow down the chain to the people. So, you know, in essence, all they've really done is bail out the banking system. And statistically, it's always amusing to me to hear them say that the recovery is underway and that the economy has turned when you've got the long-term unemployment rate still up somewhere in the vicinity of 16%. As far as I'm concerned, there's been no turn at all. Statistically, they created one, but, you know, as I always say about any of the data coming out of Washington, there's more fudge in that data than there is in a Hershey's chocolate plant.
Well, so if the consumer's not coming back, then it's, I think, healthy to say that GDP growth is going to continue to be propped up by government intervention and direct operation through QE2, QE3, or what have you. That doesn't bode well for the U.S. dollar. Of course, the dollar's not alone with other fiats. We live in a post-71 currency world in which they're all floating, or as you've described, maybe we have not a floating exchange system, but a sinking exchange system. Tell us about that.
No, that's exactly what it's been. If you look at the gold price as the measure or as the mirror reflecting the value of the four dominant currencies in the world, the pound, the yen, the Deutschmark previously, or now the euro and the dollar, they've all been falling since 1946 when the Bretton Woods Agreement was put in place to reestablish a monetary system post-World War II. Nixon closed the gold window in 1971, and that's when they started that, what I would say, rather infamous phrase that we were going on to a floating exchange rate system. And by way of floating, what we've managed to see is to see the dollar value of gold sink from $35 to $850, then up to $1,430. So an ounce of gold is still an ounce of gold. It's just how many pieces of paper do you have to spend to persuade someone to give it to you? And the problem that we've got is the extraordinary growth that has occurred in the so-called BRIC countries, China, Russia, Brazil, India, Saudi Arabia, Korea. They're the ones that now hold the bulk of foreign exchange liquidity. And they're sitting there looking at holding this, you know, $5.3 or $5.4 trillion of paper. And they look at the track record of that paper and say, why should I own it? It's losing about 4 to 5% per annum on a compound growth rate over a couple of decades. And so they're basically growing their domestic markets where they're, in essence, China's having an industrial revolution in one generation. And at the moment, they still are the largest or second or third largest holder of U.S. dollar paper. But they're spending those dollars as quickly as they can. And they're not going to be there to continue to fund the deficits that the Obama administration seemed to project out, you know, into the hereafter. And this is where you're going to have a major problem in the U.S., is the dependence on foreign lenders to finance the U.S. deficit. The dollar has already lost a lot of status in terms of the makeup or the share of international foreign exchange reserves, and I think it's going to continue to go down. And in essence, that's going to come back to reducing the overall standard of living in the United States.
Well, as some prognosticate, the end of the dollar reserve currency status, or even inflation moving from what it is to an advanced stage of double-digit annual, perhaps even more aggressive inflation, I guess one of the questions we would have is how low can the dollar go? And as we've discussed, who would bail out the dollar? Maybe this is not like the 78 period where there was others who could lend a hand, because as you mentioned, it's the British pound, it's the yen, it's the euro, who face the same travails that we do, both in terms of depreciation and inflation. But what are the resources that could be gathered to have that sort of coordinated dollar bailout a la 1978?
Well, I think probably the most significant event, and it hasn't received a great deal of attention in the U.S. media, is there's no question that the euro is undergoing a huge problem right now because of, you know, the Portugal, Greece, India, Spain, Italy, and, you know, their debt problems right now are in the spotlight, and the U.S. debt problems are sort of in the shadows at the moment. But the most material thing that's come along in the last couple of months is basically China taking a lot of its currency reserves and going to Europe to help prop up and support and sustain the existence of the euro. The thing that strikes me is it's really quite amazing, and because I speak at a lot of different conferences in the States, is the complacency with which Americans basically say, oh, we're okay because Europe's got a worse problem. And the way I often describe it is right now the dollar and the euro are in a contest to see who can be the best-looking horse in the glue factory. You know, because both of them have got comparable problems. They're slightly different. In Europe, you've got Greece, Ireland, Italy, Spain, etc. But in the United States, you've got California, Illinois, New York, and a couple of other states that are just about as bankrupt as the European countries are. But right now, the focus is in Europe. And to me, the significant thing is China stepping up to basically join Germany in sustaining the euro, because that's the other liquid currency, and they want that currency to survive, and I think that they will make it survive. There seems to be an American attitude that the euro is destined to fail. I don't think it will fail. I think it will garner international support and will be propped up, because no other country wants their currency to become the international medium of exchange. So the dollar is not going to zero. It, you know, the dollar is not going to go away. It's important for trade. It just doesn't preserve purchasing power over time. And the euro will be propped up to keep it alive. But at the same time, I think you will see all of those cash-rich countries or forex-rich countries increasingly build up their gold reserves at the same time. We'll never go back to a gold standard because, in essence, gold is just too small relative to the mountains of paper that have been created. But it's much the same way as the U.S. and Germany are two of the major holders of gold as that sort of final reserve. I think Russia is clearly doing it. They publish numbers every month showing that they continually build up their gold reserves. China, if you think of it, China's emerged as the largest gold mining country in the world, and yet they're still the biggest importers of gold in the world. Yet they only show changes in their official gold reserves very periodically. My suspicion is that we're going to get a surprise sometime in the next year in which we're going to learn that China's more than doubled their gold reserves again. And in essence, at the end of the day, gold is that in its historic form. It's the ultimate form of money, you know, defining money as a medium of exchange and store of value.
Well, the dollar is thought by many to be correlated to the movements in the gold price. You point to a different set of facts in the last gold market. Perhaps you could share that historical insight with our listeners.
Well, when people talk about the dollar and gold as if the rest of the world and the other currencies don't exist, the most material periods of time are when basically gold is rising against all of the major currencies. In the run-up from 1978 to 1980 is to me, the favorite example. The dollar had an extreme bout of weakness that drove the German mark almost through the roof in October 1978 to a degree that it precipitated an international crisis where all of the major central banks intervened to stop the decline of the dollar and put a ceiling on the German mark. That caused about a $40 sell-off in the gold price, and when the intervention occurred the first week in November 1978. And from November 78 right out until 1981, in essence, the dollar was bottoming, and the dollar was not declining. That was the period in which the gold price ran from 200 to 850. So the great gold rush that peaked in 1980 actually occurred against a bottoming dollar, not a falling dollar. In a sense, you could almost say that at that stage, gold was in catch-up mode to what had gone on before. And in many respects, I think we're in a comparable stage today. If we were to replicate what actually occurred in the 1970s, you know, when I hear people talk about a bubble, I burst out laughing and I say, to replicate the 1970s, the gold price would have to be about $5,500 an ounce today. And I quickly add, be careful what you wish for. You wouldn't like the circumstances if that's where we get to.
So that period of 1978 to 1980, just to recap, you're saying that we saw the dollar reach its lows, but it essentially moved sideways for 2 years as it bottomed out.
Exactly.
And that was the period in time that gold went from 160 or 200 to 850 an ounce in that same period.
Yeah.
So that the dollar crisis and the intervention that ensued did very little to derail gold as it moved higher. In retrospect, this is clear, as you describe it, but what most people expect is an utter collapse in the dollar for gold to move new highs, and you're saying that is not necessarily the case.
Well, I can put it this way. I think a great deal of the dollar collapse in purchasing power has already occurred. And in essence, I think by seeing the Chinese intervene to try and help stabilize the European situation, it's sort of amusing at this point. The Japanese have also got the problem where their yen is way too strong. And you've now got Bernanke with QE2 quite blatantly trying to devalue the dollar. You know, it's sort of amusing that Geithner and Bernanke are pursuing a policy, what they call a policy of lowering the purchasing power of the dollar, while they accuse China of manipulating their currency. I'm not sure that I see the difference between China's policy of tying their currency to that of their major customer. You know, that's called manipulation, but when it's the other way around, it's called policy. You know, China's actually handled this period remarkably well. You know, when you look back on it, I sort of cringe every time I hear Washington talk about the Chinese manipulating their currency, because that's exactly what Bernanke's trying to do, and the Chinese have essentially checkmated them.
Perhaps they've just done a better job. Well, the confusion over the real nature of this gold bull market is that it's more accurately a fiat currency bear market. You have a currency devaluation amongst our leading industrial nations, as you mentioned earlier, the pound, the yen, the euro, and the dollar. And frankly, given the levels of debt carried by the developed world, perhaps this should be no surprise. You've got developing countries and sovereign debt holders who would be wise to recognize that what's actually occurring in front of them or to them as holders of treasuries or other sovereign paper, this is essentially a strategic default. What do you think the road forward is for these holders of sovereign paper? Do they stand by and continue to watch their paper assets, those Forex reserves, devalued intentionally through, as you mentioned, Bernanke's policy of lowering the purchasing power?
I think that the Chinese, Brazilians, and the Koreans have already started to take steps to basically preclude the further buildup of their dollar holdings. You know, on the one hand, yes, they're trying to invest those dollar holdings by converting paper into tangible assets around the world. But you're seeing increasingly capital flow constraints and taxes and essentially penalties to try and keep the hot money from flowing into those economies that are growing. And increasingly, you're also getting bilateral arrangements. For example, the one that really caught my eye last year was Brazil and China essentially agreeing to settle their trade balances with each other in their own currency. And in essence, yes, they'll trade copper in dollar prices because that's how the global copper market works. But at the end of the year, whichever one of them has a balance of trade surplus, that surplus is settled either in real or RMB or Chinese yuan. So what they're doing by that is they're stopping the buildup of the major currency reserves. And you've got the same thing more recently announced between China and Russia. You know, and China and Russia have never exactly had what you'd call great relations, but they're now basically trading with each other on a bilateral basis. And increasingly, they're looking for ways to essentially settle trade outside of the three major currencies. And this is where I think you've seen on the global stage last year, where you had the G7 meetings and the G20 meetings. The G7 basically is the old boys club that thought they were telling the world how to operate. And it's become increasingly clear that the G20 is now the dominant group because they are the guys that have the money. And there's been a huge political shift on that global stage. But the bilateral settlements, the rich countries dealing with each other to preclude the buildup of more foreign paper is a very material step. And in the meantime, the Chinese are never going to call up Goldman Sachs and say sell $4 trillion or $2 trillion worth of U.S. bonds, because they know that that will immediately prompt a risk protectionist response or a penalizing response from Congress. Nobody wants the dollar to blow up. It's an important element for international trade. But at the same time, they're sick and tired of having Geithner and the Fed trying to tell them what to do when it's quite clear that, to go back to the old sort of family phrase, physician, heal thyself first. The U.S. is in a mess, and yet they're trying to tell the rest of the world how to get into the same kind of mess. And the rest of the world's had enough.
What seems like the dynamics, then, that support the bull market in gold, as we mentioned, are not necessarily dollar-related at all, but when you look at the global issues in foreign currency and the reserve issues that each of these central banks are having to make critical decisions on, they're making the same decisions that many investors are today, and it's looking at their cash reserves and saying, denomination, denomination, denomination. Mm-hmm. What is our reference currency? And perhaps a fiat denomination is not what they want. To a certain degree, and at this point, a very small degree, it's the metal's beginning to take a greater role.
Well, exactly. And you're seeing it in the newly industrialized countries. You're seeing it where basically a great deal of the run-up in things like copper, platinum, iron ore, consumable metals as well, and consumable minerals, you've got people converting paper into tangibles. Dennis Gartman always uses the wonderful phrase, if you drop it on your foot and it hurts, it's something you want to own, you know, the tangible stuff. And in essence, we're seeing all of the commodity spectrum begin to reflect the purchasing power of the currencies in which the trade is denominated. And again, it comes back to gold number one, silver number two, trading on its monetary history, as well as its industrial demand, and then out to the other metals. I'm sort of amused when I hear talk about, you know, they're going to launch several large copper ETFs in which they're going to store the copper in warehouses to get around the forward market transaction costs. When you look at the actual specific gravity density of copper, I don't know what kind of vaults they're going to store it in, but it's going to cost about 100 times more than it costs to store silver, which is a lot more expensive than storing gold. So that, to me, there's an awful lot of paper product being created by Wall Street to try and participate in this trend that probably isn't going to work all that well. At the end of the day, and this, I take this, many of your readers probably are familiar with Central Fund of Canada, the CEF.
Certainly.
I was one of the founders on converting Central Fund into a stock exchange tradable bullion proxy. It's essentially a Canadian entity holding nothing but physical gold and physical silver in Canada. And I always used to see, because Americans are afraid that Franklin Roosevelt might get reelected. You know, gold and silver have the monetary history. They have great value per ounce in that sense. It makes sense to store them. But the best way to own gold and silver still, in my opinion, is in your hot little hand. In Central Fund, we tried to create what I often call the second best way to own gold and silver.
Well, what expectations do you have of the gold-silver ratio over the next several years? We're currently at 48. On the high side, we've seen 80 to 100. On the low side, we've seen perhaps a market anomaly at 15 to 17 during the Hunt Brother days, an average of more like 30 to 40. Where do you see it going in this environment with, you know, poor man's gold taking on perhaps some appeal simply because the price of gold is getting up there in terms of its access to the man on the street?
Well, I think a very long-term median argument could be made for something like 35 to 1. When you talk about the 15-to-1 anomaly of the Hunt brothers, in point of fact, geologists will talk about the occurrence of gold and silver in the ground is about a 15-to-1 ratio. Although the problem, of course, is that silver has much higher mining cost. But on a very long-term basis, we've had a range, as you cite, you know, roughly 40-to-80-to-1 vaguely since the mid-1980s. Prior to that, the range was more in the area of 50-to-1 to 15-to-1. I conservatively expect to see something on the order of 35-to-1. In essence, I think if we were going to replicate the inflation-adjusted gold price of 1980, which today would be approaching $2,500 sometime in the next year or so. So I would expect to see that $2,500 gold price be able to convert into about 35 ounces of silver, i.e. that silver still would have further to go. But in the last half, for the last couple of months of 2010, coming into 2011, there's no question that this last rally that took silver beyond the breakout of 21 up to over 30, that got a little frothy, got ahead of itself, and, you know, quite frankly, I'd like to see it come back down into the low 20s, somewhere in the 22, 23 area. I'd be a lot more bullish about it than I would, you know, trying to buy every little dip under 30. And in the same vein, I keep seeing these marvelous articles about gold being in a bubble. And I regularly try to point out to people that the venerable Financial Times of London has managed to produce a bubble top article on the gold price at virtually every $100 increment since it crossed 400. So, you know, I find the bubble articles amusing rather than illuminating. And in the recent periods, you know, we've had the gold price run from 850, 700, 850 up to 1400 and come back $100 or so. Everybody seems to get mesmerized by big numbers. I like to try and point out to people that if you've got a stock that ran from $8.50 to $14, do you get all antsy because it came back to 13.5 or 13.25, maybe 12.5? If you think of it in those terms, we've been building a very orderly, almost linear trend going back a whole decade, where this thing has been literally a linear trend. We haven't even seen a possible parabolic curve on it. And you really don't have much in the way of great speculation until you get into that parabolic curve. And I think that still lies ahead of us over the next 2 or 3 years, and the problem is it could come sooner.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com.
Well, transitioning to bonds and interest rates, because certainly I would agree with you, the manic dynamics have yet to emerge in the gold market. Perhaps above 1500, somewhere in the range of 1500 to 2500, you could begin to argue that there is more people in the general public with an interest in gold, but today there's more people selling than buying, even if it's gold trinkets and gold jewelry, liquidating what they have to pay bills. But as you mentioned, the Financial Times and CNBC is right in there. They would disagree, I think, with us both that the bull market has in fact ended. We're in a present decline, as evidenced by the last $20 move down. and you're wise to point out that in percentage terms, these are insignificant moves. In fact, right in line with what we've seen for the past decade, an orderly two steps forward and one step back. One of the things that you do so well is technical analysis. And, you know, I look at trends in the interest rate market, which have covered long stretches of time. And remember Alan Shaw and Louise Yamada at Solomon Smith Barney. They did a study back in 2004, and they incorporated 200 years of various bond yields or interest rates. And what they showed was that trends in the interest rate environment lasted from 22 to 36 years, with an average of about 28 years in duration. This is specifically U.S. interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one direction or the other, either up, down, sideways. Leads me to ask, now that we've shifted debt from private entities to the public, this transition and the bursting of the credit bubble circa 2007 to present, clearly we've socialized the risk taken by individuals and individual firms. Where do rates go from here, in your opinion? Looking at it technically, if you want to support that with fundamental arguments, but technically, where do you think we go from here?
I think technically that interest rates have seen their lows. In essence, you've had, in recent times, you get these spikes down in the long rates, typically coincident with panic in the stock market. When the stock market panics, basically people still flee to bonds. You know, CNBC calls it a flight to safety. I often refer to it as a flight to liquidity. Also, because when their people are worried about their margin accounts, they get more margin on their bond holdings than they do on their stock holdings. But in essence, I think you've seen the lows in interest rates. And perhaps the most interesting observation of all is that since Bernanke's Jackson Hole speech in August and the commencement of, you know, when he announced that he was going to do QE2 and then has subsequently done the QE2 or quantitative easing 2, of basically buying $90 billion a month of Treasury bonds. It's been sort of amusing that with this tremendous buyer in the market, interest rates have gone up, not down. And in essence, what the market is doing is the market's looking right through them and say, okay, we can see exactly what you're trying to do and have on you. And what's interesting to me is the QE2 is in fact such a blatant form of money printing that the bond market has started to reflect it. I did a webcast for a fund group back in November in which I talked about if the 30-year or the long bond futures contract broke 129, that would really confirm that a significant trend was changing. And that contract broke about 2 weeks later, and it's now down to about 20. And what's interesting is that all of the bonds that Bernanke's traders are buying are basically now reflecting a loss for the Fed's balance sheet. And of particular interest, this past week, the Fed's announced that they're going to change their accounting rules so that they don't mark their holdings to market. So I don't know how, in the private sector, we'd call it fraud, but unfortunately, fraud's not a crime in their sector, in the public sector. It's extraordinary what's going on. And in my view, the credibility of the Treasury market is increasingly going to face scrutiny internationally, which is going to encourage the international participation to continue to shrink. And again, if you've got escalating deficits, I don't know how prices do anything but go down. You know, when you need more and more money and you're running into increasingly reluctant buyers, and basically if bond prices are going down because interest rates are going up. And I think it's the international vigilantes of the bond market that are going to drive U.S. interest rates up in spite of Bernanke's intervention.
Well, it seems they may be the only ones with the gumption to look at what you just suggested, change in accounting rules, as significantly important to the bond market. You know, just as the change in FASB requirements for the banking industry have allowed them to keep garbage paper on their books without having to mark it to market, now you're saying the Fed gets to do the same thing. The U.S. investment public, I think, could care less. They do listen to CNBC. They do read the Financial Times on occasion, certainly the Wall Street Journal, or USA Today is probably the biggest American read next to People magazine. But what we do have is a crystallizing in the sovereign debt market of real risk and real risk of default. If it's not outright default, the kinds of default that we've seen in the 80s in Latin America and other parts of the world, certainly through inflation, a more subtle form of default. This is the frustrating thing, and perhaps you can comment on this. When does the market realize that the pricing in treasuries does not reflect that risk? You know, that this direct intervention of the Fed and the quantitative easing which is occurring is distorting prices and actually keeping them somewhat healthy. You know, from September to present, we've moved from 3.5% on the 30-year to 4.6%. That's a pretty strong move from September to the present. And yet I think we'd see even more volatility in the price and yield if it wasn't for the government in there actually monetizing debt. Of course, the efficient market hypothesis is out the window, but, you know, when does the market realize, domestic or international, that the pricing in treasuries is totally skewed?
It's going to come along. I think in a sense it's already underway in the muni market. There's increasingly focus on the municipal market. The most interesting thing is, you know, watching Governor Moonbeam come back into power in California, that there's no real mechanism for a state by itself to go bankrupt within the U.S. bankruptcy code. But I saw one article in the past week where they were talking about the city of Vallejo in California trying to settle its debt for 5 to 20 cents on the dollar. I think that's the second time they've done that I can recall. And people are going to start looking at the concept of credit ratings. What do the credit ratings mean? As far as I'm concerned, the credit raters of the past decade should be sharing a cell with Bernie Madoff. You know, and it's going to come into the credibility of the credit markets is increasingly going to come into play. And this is where I think you're seeing this return of a buildup of savings, that as the money is being injected into the system by the economy, those that are in a position to save are saving it. They're not buying treasury bonds. They're not buying municipal bonds. And in many respects, they're being sucked into buying some common stocks. But I think increasingly you're going to see them reducing debt. And that's the problem that the economy faces going forward, is that the credibility of the U.S. credit markets is increasingly sliding. But bear in mind, I think probably the ultimate line was James Dine some years ago, is the last person to learn about the bubble is the guy that's living inside it. And in many respects, the American investing public is living inside the bubble, that believes that somehow or other Bernanke has this magic switch where he can make everybody feel better. And in the history of money and credit, I like to point out that Bernanke calls himself a student of the Great Depression. I assume that he's a great expert on the Great Depression, but I also assume he failed all of his courses in the history of money and credit because he doesn't seem to understand that at the end of the day, that money and credit is going to implode.
Well, one last question on interest rates, and then perhaps we can look at the stock market in brief. You know, Wall Street believes that higher rates are gold negative. You know, this is a familiar refrain. Whenever someone lifts rates, even a quarter of a point, maybe you can take us back to the late 70s and early 80s, that what level was gold affected by higher interest rates?
Only when the real return on paper, i.e. the nominal interest rate minus the inflation rate, when the real return on paper got high, that began to impact the gold price. On the run up to 850, you had treasury bills and longer term rates all above 8%. And I sort of chuckle when I hear people talk about a 50 basis point rise over the next 2 years and the Fed funds rate would kill the gold market. I think if you got the Fed funds rate up to 6% and the inflation rate to 5%, which I don't see that happening, at that point you'd have a positive real return on paper. That would put some pressure on the gold market. And you basically have Bernanke making blanket statements that that's not going to be allowed to happen. You know, it's real returns on paper that would impact the gold price, and we're so far from that, I wouldn't even contemplate trying to put a number on it.
In reality, Bernanke's not open to raising rates. The market would have to do that at the long end of the curve, because with the debt that we carry, we're looking at moving the ceiling up again from 14.3 to even higher, 14.3 trillion. The issue is the interest portion on the national debt at 5% and 6%. Is a massive percentage of GDP, and it's not something that they can even entertain. That may be a slightly different position than the 70s, when Volcker could step in and run rates to the moon in order to crush inflation, because even though we had more debt than in previous generations, it still was nothing on the scale that we have today. Well, that's helpful. 8% is kind of the number from the 70s. Something like 6% with an inflation rate of 5 might be in line, you think, today. Well, global stocks, you know, you look at equities, both domestic and international. Are we in the eye of the storm? Certainly, sentiment is as positive as it can get. And that what's awkward is that while sentiment is positive on the street, Main Street, that is, on Wall Street and with corporate executives, you've had over the last 3 months record liquidations of their own shares. So are we in the eye of the storm?
I think we're in the presence of a very significant top. And in my annual forecast newsletter, I've made the point that I think that 2011 is probably going to turn out to be the first negative year for the S&P that coincides with the so-called pre-election year of the presidential election cycle. You haven't had a down year in the pre-election year since World War II. But given the midterm year, 2010 was supposed to be the bad year, and it turned out to be an inflated year, thanks to Bernanke. I don't think he can repeat that magic for 2011. And we've come into 2011 with the most extraordinary complacency and enthusiasm that somehow all the problems have gone away. And I am extremely nervous about this market because I think it's flying on fumes at this point. And you're starting to see the various divergence in a variety of sectors. I think quite correctly point out that insider selling is going on at an extraordinary rate. And I think I just saw one report where it was the first time in which there was one sequence of, or one time frame in which there was absolutely zero insider buying. You think of an Excel spreadsheet with a div by zeros. How do you calculate a purchase to sales ratio if there's no buying? I think 2011 is coming in with sentiment extraordinarily high, and I suspect that we'll see the opposite extreme before the year is out.
So with areas of divergence and a significant top potentially forming in 2011, you know, we certainly would agree with that, but we do question how far can quantitative easing take you? You know, we've added a significant amount since the announcement of quantitative easing 1 and 2. Is there now a conflict between quantitative easing 2 and 3 and what the bond market might vote? And will the bond market hold quantitative easing in check? That's kind of one question that lingers in our minds. The other that I'd love for you to comment on is it seems this is a period reminiscent of 1966 to 1982, where the stock market really didn't go anywhere for a long period of time. There was no catalyst, if anything, catalyst to the downside, but not only a lost decade, even a little bit more than a decade.
Well, in many respects, I've been suggesting since the top, the technology talk from the stock market in 2000, I've been suggesting that we're into one of those great long sideways periods where the top of 2000 and the bottom of the 2002 crash might define the range for a period of 15 to 20 years. And in a sense, that's what we're doing. We went a little bit higher in 2007. We went a little bit lower at the 2009 range. But it's not dissimilar to what occurred from 1966 to 1982. But in that period, the deflated, if you take inflation out of the stock market, the constant dollar decline of the stock market from 1966 to 1982 was really quite extraordinary. I think what Bernanke is trying to accomplish, without saying so, is I think he's trying to pull off a replica of that period. The problem is that when you look back over, you know, 100 years or more of history, the other alternative would be to go back into the period of 1929 to 1949. And in that case, the wheels did fall off, where that period started off with the Great Crash, and then you went into the sideways periods from 1933 to 49. But I think that we're in one of those periods right now. So when I see some of the small stock components, for example, threatening their highs or making new highs relative to their 2007 peak and all this bullish sentiment, I would point out to people that we're probably in the range and we're much more likely at this point to be probing the lows that we saw in March of 2009 than we are to see the massive stocks going above the highs that they had in 2007. And if we're lucky, we stay within that range. If there are any material accidents along the way, systemic type accidents that may be precipitated globally, I would say the greater risks are on the downside. So to me, the risk reward of the current stock market is just all risk and very little remaining potential reward. I wouldn't touch the stock market with Obama's money, let alone my own.
Well, many discussions with one of our guests, Russell Napier, through the years have pointed to 2014 to 2016 as a period where equities are likely to be cheap, and specifically following a collapse in sovereign debt and a rise in interest rates. You know, the period of 1980 to 82 was significant for many investors entering the bond and equity markets, and we've mentioned a couple of time frames here as well. 1949 was one of those periods of time where it made sense to be looking at equities coming out of a long period of consolidation. Those were intense periods. Certainly, sentiment was negative as it could be, and yet that was when value emerged. How does the period 2014 to 2016 sit with you?
On a time frame basis, 15, 16, maybe out to 18. If we're lucky that we don't have a systemic accident prior to then, probably the best really true long-term measure of relative value of the stock market would be to come right back down to dividend yields. And, you know, historically, Edson Gould back in the 1950s and 60s used to publish the fact that whenever the stock market yielded less than 3% using the broad index, that the market was high and overvalued. And when the yield was in excess of 6%, and it has been as high as 9% yield on dividends, at that point, the stock market is truly undervalued. Well, we haven't been at 3%, the overvalued level. We haven't been that high in dividend yields since Greenspan started flooding the system with liquidity back in the 90s. And since that period, whenever people got scared, they went into Treasury paper. If Treasury paper is going to come under increasing suspicion, it's entirely possible that the money flow in markets will, in fact, go back to seeking dividend payments. And I would say that when you get the S&P yield over 6% rather than the 2% it is right now, at that point you can begin to argue of common stocks as being significantly valued and attractively priced for future investment. I think we will see 6% yields on common stocks at some point in the next several years. It's certainly not going to happen tomorrow because you'd have to decimate, or you'd have to have a reverse split of the S&P to get yield down to that level at this point.
Well, what does the journey look like moving from the present Dow gold ratio of about 8.75, 8.5, almost 9 to 1, to 3 or even 2 to 1? A double dose of volatility, or do you think it would be more one-sided, favoring an up move in the gold market or a down move in equities?
Well, bear in mind that we've seen a one-to-one ratio twice over the last 120 years, and I know that James Dines and Richard Russell and others have pointed to the anticipation that we'll see a one-to-one ratio again. Maybe it's only a two-to-one, but if, you know, for example, if it's a one-to-one ratio, does that occur at 5,000 Dow, $5,000 gold, 10,000 Dow, 5,000 gold? It's almost impossible to try and pick a number where that could occur. What it really tells you is that gold relative to the Dow is sort of a financial versus tangible ratio that's traveled from an extreme back in 1999 of 44 to 1 down to less than 10 to 1. And I've seen some people publish that ratio on an arithmetic scale chart and said, well, you know, all the easy money's been made, so the game's over. But you know, you've got to put a ratio onto a semi-log chart, and when you put it onto a semi-logarithmic scale, we're basically about halfway there. And what that trend really says is that for several years yet to come, the gold price is going to perform better than the Dow. Now, what the magic number will be that would create a 2-to-1 ratio or a 1-to-1 ratio, I haven't got any clue at all. But I just know that the trend of that ratio tells me I sleep a lot better at night owning gold than I do owning the Dow.
And it seems that the journey between here and there includes a significant sub-story, which is an investor who's willing to own metals today and consider a transition tomorrow with a part of their metals assets is looking at an 8x purchasing power on the other side, coming from an 8.75, and if we should see a 1-to-1 ratio, as you mentioned, this is an exponential growth in terms of purchasing power, which is pretty interesting if you're thinking about intergenerational wealth.
If I could add to that, be careful what you wish for, because believe me, nobody's going to enjoy the circumstances that creates a 1-to-1 or even a 2-to-1 ratio. But in terms of intergenerational wealth preservation, gold will stand and has stood the test of time. I've got charts showing that, for example, for British citizens going back a couple of centuries. But the biggest problem, I think, is that way too many people look at the gold market and we're going to see increasing volatility, and they start thinking like short-term traders. And the nature of short-term trading, if you started off as an investor, is I can almost guarantee you'll be out of the market at the wrong time almost every time. Gold is something to hold for the major trend. Don't try to trade the short-term swings.
That's well advised, and we appreciate it. The last note on deliberations, what's the website you'd like for our listeners to go to if they're interested in looking at a copy, either a sample copy or a subscription to the newsletter as I would strongly recommend it. Your technical analysis is second to none.
Well, ironically, I don't even operate my own website. My primary chart provider has a website up there that has all the subscription information. And it basically is www.chartguy.com/deliberations. Or if they do a Google search for deliberations and Ian McAvity, that'll lead them probably to that page.
And we'll go ahead and include that link on our website so people can just click right through.
And I'd be happy to send them a free sample copy of the newsletter so they can see the work that I actually do.
You'd be crazy not to take Ian up on that. Certainly look at it and consider a long-term subscription. Ian, I enjoyed seeing you in New Orleans. Look forward to seeing you again when we can, if our paths should cross soon. There's a lot to talk about, and we appreciate you joining our conversation. Our clients and listeners have benefited greatly by it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Ian McAvity. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.